Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Gina McAndrews. Hello, Gina.
Hello, Susan. It's great to be back on Local Talk, especially for a show about agriculture. You knew I grew up on a farm over in eastern Iowa and really have a strong interest in agriculture and a lot of experience. But I think your usual co-host, Paul Wearson, also grew up on a farm. Where is he today?
He probably would be here, except that he's been very involved with Ragtime in Randall, which will be coming up this weekend. So this week, he'll come on as a guest at the end of the program to give us a preview of one of his favorite events.
So that's how I got to accompany you on that wonderful trip to White Rock Conservancy. That was a lucky break for me.
It was a lucky break for KHOI as well. Not only did you grow up on a farm, you also taught in the ISU Agronomy Department for many years. So you were the ideal person to ask questions.
Well, we'll see who asked the most questions when we get to the road trip part of the show. But first, I know you had a great interview with the new director of Practical Farmers of Iowa, Sally Worley. I wasn't able to be here when she came into the studio, so I'm really eager to hear what she had to say. I've been a member of Practical Farmers of Iowa for several years, so why did you decide to devote most of this week's program to agriculture?
It really started with last week's program on the World Food Prize, which focused on food production in Africa. As I listened, I realized that a lot of the way people grow food throughout the world starts right here. That made me want to explore the variety of approaches to agriculture here in central Iowa. Many people, even here in central Iowa, see the rows of corn and soybeans with the logos of seed companies displayed on the fence posts and get the idea that all Iowa agriculture is like that. Partly from exploring the World Food Prize and its critics last week, I had a lot of questions about whether that's an accurate analysis.
Great idea. Let's hear what Sally has to say.
Well, I'm here with Sally Worley, the new director of Practical Farmers of Iowa. Thanks for coming in today, Sally.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Now, you just became director, but I understand you've been with Practical Farmers for several years.
That is correct. I became the director this February. I started as a staff there in 2007, and prior to that, I was a member of the organization for about 4 years.
And what did you were a member of the organization? Does that mean you were a farmer?
Kind of. I worked for the homestead east of Pleasant Hill, Iowa, and I led their vocational program, which is ag-based. And the homestead is a living and learning center for adults with autism, and our vocational program is still based around 6 or 7 acres of fruits and vegetables, an acre apple orchard, and a large greenhouse. So while I was employed there, I was a member of Practical Farmers, highly regarded the organization, and a job came open, and I fortunately was hired for that in 2007, and I've been at Practical Farmers since.
Now, how long has Practical Farmers been in existence?
Practical Farmers turned 31 this year. It was founded in 1985. It was founded between Dick and Sharon Thompson, as well as Larry Callum. It was founded with the premise that farmers are curious, experienced, and experts in their in farming, which seems glaringly obvious, but is not always regarded that way. And Dick Thompson had been doing some on-farm research and field days on his farm already. Larry Callum saw that he was doing this great work, and with a group of founding members, they helped formalize Practical Farmers into the network that it is today. Back then, it was founded on the same farmer-led mentality, and today our mission is strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigation and information sharing. It's very similar in its scope and its values as it was then. farmers lead our programming, and we provide extensive opportunities for our members to learn from each other. Although it's grown in size, we have about 3,000 members now, and it's grown in diversity of enterprises. When it started out, it was largely, not all, but largely diverse crop and livestock farms. Now our network is full of farmers of many different farm sizes. So we have farmers who have less than an acre in an urban area, and they are trying to make a living that way, to farmers who have thousands of acres. They might have confinement feeding operation on their farm. Very diverse group of farmers, and they have diverse goals, but they come together with the shared goals of learning from each other and improving their farms. You know, it's a very interesting mix of farmers, and our big tent mentality, which we strive hard to preserve, is what makes Practical Farmers of Iowa so effective. We are providing venues for people to get together who have different perspectives and are coming from different places in their farming career. And we provide safe venues for them to talk openly with each other and respectfully. And that often helps people understand where other people are coming from. For instance, you might be an organic vegetable grower. And if you have the opportunity to talk with a large row crop grower, you may then understand why they're applying pesticides to their farm. It makes a lot more sense if you hear it from their perspective with their reasonings rather than making assumptions which may not be accurate. We do have people different opinion, obviously, and we do use Dick Thompson's mentality of get along, don't go along, to help people realize there is room at the table for differing practices and opinions, and being transparent and open to each other is a effective dialogue to make positive change in Iowa.
Well, there are a lot of potential changes that are pretty controversial. And let's start with some of the ones that are most controversial. The one that we heard quite a bit about during the World Food Prize last week was GMOs. Do you have anybody using GMOs?
Sure. In our membership, and I would like to point out that our membership is part of who we work with, but about half of attendees at our events are non-members. So it's reaching up beyond those who are formal members, but quite a few of them use GMO crops. Now, we have a range of farm sizes. We also have a range of farm enterprises where people are growing. Our most common enterprises are corn, beans, hay, as is the landscape in Iowa. But then beyond that, beef, cattle, on down the line, we have a lot more representation of alternative systems, including fruits and vegetables, goats, alternative livestock. And then among that group of enterprises, we have people who are certified organic. We have people certified naturally grown. We have people who are GMO-free. We have people who are using long-term crop rotations. But then we also have people who are planting just corn and beans and using GMO crops. So we have the whole gamut in our membership.
Now, you mentioned, how do I get to this? Is it possible to grow GMOs without what might be called the GMO technology, namely the pesticides and the fertilizers?
Well, you mentioned the World Food Prize, and the main argument that they are leading is that we need to feed the world, so we need to be more efficient with our technology, and GMOs allow us to do that. Some of that rhetoric is doubling production to feed the world as the population increases. Some of our members do, I think, subscribe to that technology. Others are using GMO seeds because that's what's commercially available, while others, like I said, are choosing to use non-GMO seeds on their farms. Some farmers, though, in our membership are using GMO seeds because the traits that they are looking for, such as drought tolerance or days to maturity, are not available in similar seed without the GMO traits in there, so they will pay extra for those seeds, but they might not be using the glyphosate that goes along with the prescription for that seed.
And what do they do about fertilizers?
If we're looking at a glyphosate-ready GMO seed, that's made so it can have glyphosate applied to it. It does not change a fertility scheme on a farm. So they're using similar fertilization between GMO and non-GMO seeds. Now, what is that on their farm? Gosh, that varies widely. If it's traditional nitrogen applications, if it's manures, if it's cover crops, if it's crop rotation. So that will be fairly similar between a GMO and a non-GMO field. So when we create our goals and priorities for the organization, we are listening closely to what our farmers' priorities are, what they feel like their barriers to success are, and to what their goals are in helping them reach those. So we have three main goals right now in our current strategic plan, and one of those is farmers are stewards of our natural resources. And that is based on what our farmers are prioritizing. And some of their goals under that are decreasing the use of external inputs, which would include pesticides and fertilizers, increasing their use of cover crops, adding third crops to their corn and soybean rotations. Overall, that they report they have increased their stewardship, they have increased their conservation investment, which can be stuff like the prairie strips, buffers, or wetlands, and that they have increased renewable energy or conservation on their farms. So those goals are coming from our farmers and what they want to employ on their farms as they are looking to achieve a triple bottom line of profit, community health, as well as health for future generations. Our farmers are great examples of what farmers can do to mitigate nitrogen runoff in Iowa. A lot of them are leaders in figuring out how to mitigate the nitrogen coming off their farms. So what we are doing is working with those who have had successes as well as failures to help others learn how they can mitigate nitrogen on their farms. Over the years, we have been known as an organization of ridge tillers or no tillers. Neither are accurate, although they might have been more prevalent in our past years. Our network is too complex to categorize as no-tillers or ridge tillers. We have people who will advocate for no-till. We have others on the flip side who say, yes, but you're going to use more chemicals, so that's not healthy. So again, it's one of the tools in the toolbox that our farmers use. And rather than identify whether that's right or not overall, we provide our farmers with the information so that they can make decisions that best work for their farms and their communities.
Although I brought up no-till, I think it might be helpful to our listeners if you describe what it is.
You are not disturbing your ground through tilling. That can have some positive effects, such as not disturbing your soil structure, as well as minimizing erosion because you don't have that freshly tilled ground there. However, when you're looking at things like perennial weeds, you can have some larger issues. So again, that's a conversation that our farmers could talk about for hours on end about the benefits or the disadvantages of no-till or about any other farming system out there. I think one thing you learn coming to Practical Farmers of Iowa and listening to a bunch of different farmers is that, as with life, very few things are black and white. Everything's very complicated. We spend a lot of time showcasing farmers across Iowa. We try to communicate that we are showing them as examples and not models, because what works right for one farm and community may not work right in the neighboring county. So yeah, we talk about a lot of different topics, and no-till would be one of the many that are discussed.
One of the biggest changes in agriculture from the kind of farms that were prevalent when I was growing up, the farmers that used to have really mixed farms, they'd have cattle, they'd have milk cows, they'd have horses, they'd have chickens, sometimes ducks and geese, and this is probably still a lot of corn and hay, but these farms were very labor-intensive, and they had big farm families, and that was how they got their labor. And a lot of people who grew up in that, even if they're a little nostalgic for some aspects, would not want to go back to farming like that. And so when they hear about some of the criticisms of mechanized farming, they say, well, it's absolutely necessary, and it may be necessary. How do you deal with the labor-intensive part of some of the smaller farms, particularly organic farms?
While technology has improved a lot of processes on farms, improved yield, there have also been some negative effects. So as you drive across Iowa now, you'll see abandoned homesteads, which were even 30 years ago, you know, there were flowers out front. There is a sandbox out there because kids were present. Now, as I'm sure you know, two-thirds of our counties are decreasing in population. And a lot of that is because we are an egg-based state that is becoming less egg-based as our farms are getting larger. The jobs are getting less. The farms are becoming more vulnerable, too, because they are less diversified. That diversity does bring with it some more labor, but it also brings resilience. So if you have a crop failure, then you have another crop that you can depend on. And a lot of our farms use diversity as insurance. But I think a lot of people get confused when they hear about people going back to the land or working with nature. They assume people are going back to doing farming how it was in the 40s. And maybe some aspects they are. They might be even going as far as wanting to bring draft horses back to their farm, whether that's a good idea or not. Definitely a labor-intensive one. But people are adding to their knowledge, and there's a lot more knowledge than there was in the 40s. So even if they're trying to become more cognizant of natural rhythms and provide more labor on their farms, they're trying to do so in a way that makes it possible for people to have jobs in those communities. Now, that's not an easy task by any means, but one of the goals that our members have brought forth is community. So one of our main goals that we're working on is Practical Farmers of Iowa, building community in Iowa and beyond. We're doing that because of the degradation we're seeing in some of these rural communities, but mainly because our members feel isolated. They want somebody to talk to. They want to feel accepted for trying research on their farms or trying something different. And they do. They want the schools to stay open in their neighborhoods. They want to see thriving business, not have everybody have to go into Des Moines to do their shopping. So it's a very complex issue.
Well, one of the problems with farm labor, of course, is that it's seasonal.
Yes.
And so how do you deal with that issue? I mean, migrant labor was the old solution, and immigrants are now, in many cases, the solution. And immigrants apparently will stick around when American-born employees won't. I just did a story on Webster City, and their Lao population stuck around because it was home and it was the place they wanted to be. But you don't have that kind of possibility for, I mean, it's not just a matter of loyalty. People who want to stay in their hometown can't.
Right. Well, we are working our third goal. That's a good segue to say what our third goal is for farmers, farms, and food systems to be viable. So we're working on that in a couple of ways. One is farmers do need labor. They need to create systems where they can afford to pay laborers a fair wage. So we're helping them on their profitability. We are asking them and encouraging them to share their actual production and financial data with each other so that we can have more dialogue about the actual numbers happening in Iowa on production. We are also, some of our farms are interested in how they can make that seasonal job year-round. So we are helping connect them with resources and other farmers who have experience in creating year-round positions. And we do have a program called Labor for Learning, which has two main goals. It helps aspiring farmers see if farming is right for them. We have a surge of people coming to Practical Farmers of Iowa as aspiring and beginning farmers. This is very encouraging as we see the number of farmers on the decline in Iowa and as we see land getting ready to transition as many farmers retire. However, farming is extremely difficult, and we really want these farmers to come back, but we want them to be knowledgeable about what they are getting into and making sure they have the resources and skills to be successful. So through Labor for Learning, we're pairing aspiring farmers with experienced farms to get on-the-job experience before they embark on becoming a farmer themselves. That is also supplying these experienced farms with some employees and some labor from people who are invested in farming and they care about being successful. So hopefully we're creating those two goals with that. Labor is an ongoing need for our farmers, as is land access for our beginning farmers. A lot of those have the same criteria needed: housing, schools, jobs for spouses. So there are complex issues that get into the thread of rural communities and the strength of them in Iowa.
An organization like Practical Farmers must require quite a lot of money to run. I noticed you have a pretty extensive staff.
We do.
And how are you funded?
Yeah, we have been growing, which is wonderful, but also puts pressure on us to keep the funding coming in to keep our staff employed. And we have a fabulous staff right now, so we want to do that. We are largely funded through grants, and we have a combination of state, federal, and foundation grants that fund our work. We work really hard to make sure we're still member-driven and not grant-driven. An important thing, we are also funded by sponsorships. So we get our two main things we ask for sponsorships for are our field days as well as our annual conference. And we do a good job getting sponsorships. That's fairly easy for us to do because we do have that group of farmers coming together. So we have people who want to reach them. And so it's really a win-win we see, hopefully. And it seems like a good relationship. We also depend on individual donations as well as our membership dollars. The sponsorships, individual donations, and membership dollars are very important because that gives us the flexibility to be farmer-led and make sure that we are following up on what our members want to learn from each other.
Well, when you say sponsorships, I think about on radio we have sponsorships, but they're just people announcing that they're sponsors. Now, your sponsors have tables at your conferences and so forth?
At our conference, our sponsors have the option to exhibit, and most but not all do that. So that gives them the opportunity. Last year, it gave them the opportunity to visit with 968 attendees, either farms or those friends of farmers interested in farming in Iowa. So it gives them a great opportunity to connect with this community that they are trying to service as well.
And you don't have any limitations?
We don't. We do get grumblings every year that, oh, I can't believe this person's sponsoring or that person's sponsoring, and why would you take their money? And that's on both sides of the table. However, there's no strings attached. We're very clear that we provide them exhibit space and recognition in our brochure, and that's where, as far as the relationship goes. However, if you talk with our sponsors, they're very happy to be able to talk with new people, and they are getting new relationships as a result without sullying our work or our reputation.
Thank you, Sally. That was Sally Worley, Executive Director of Practical Farmers of Iowa. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. I'm your host, Susan Franzen, with my co-host, Gina McAndrews, who accompanied me on a road trip to the White Rock Conservancy yesterday.
Thank you for calling me, Susan. That was a great trip. I've always enjoyed our road trips, but this one was really special. A nice drive to White Rock Conservancy on a beautiful sunny day. And it's a 5,500-acre nonprofit land trust that balances sustainable agriculture, natural resource protection, and public recreation on the landscape.
Yes, it's an impressive as well as a beautiful place. And I can't think of a better demonstration of the principles of Practical Farmers of Iowa as Sally Worley described them in the first part of the program.
Yes, but the information was pretty overwhelming. As we sat on that lovely day visiting on the screened-in porch at Liz Garth's house for an hour and a quarter, I kept wishing we could transport our listeners to experience the beautiful fall afternoon with the chickadees twittering in the bushes just beyond the screen. Of course, there are some other background noises that might be a little more distracting. The trucks and combine driving down the road. And then my little dog, Buddy, had a little bark in there at a squirrel. And that lovely chair I was in had a little creak.
Yes, I kept wondering how we could do except just to explain that to our listeners. And we've connected the fragments of the conversation about agriculture at the White Rock Conservancy, interspersed with a few bars of the ragtime song Mary's Joy, played by Reginald Robinson, who was the featured performer at Ragtime for Randall a couple of years ago. So let's see how that works.
Our ethic is income is important to us, too, not just being green. And that's where we hope to persuade conventional farmers to be doing a better job. So some of the practices we've been doing, the Garths were conservation farmers from long ago, and I've always been very interested in conservation, in particular of soil. Iowa's lost more than 50% of its topsoil, and Iowa has lost more than 50% of the organic matter in the topsoil that's left. So we have lost 3/4 of, for example, our sponge, which reduces flooding. We have a lot of soil health problems that could really help our water quality problem. So we're focused on soil health here more directly than we are on water. There will be improvements to water doing the techniques we use. Water is in the news right now. Soil is our bigger problem. Soil is a forever problem.
Along those lines, my background's in stream ecology. You can't have healthy aquatic systems without having a healthy soil base. And if you don't do your upland practices, you never will have a healthy aquatic ecosystem.
So some of those practices are, some of them are pretty basic practices that really still work. Terraces. Terraces are a wonderful thing for helping control soil erosion. We have been no-tillers here for, I believe, almost 50 years now, 40 years plus anyway. We have a lot of land that hasn't been tilled in 40 years, and we're very proud of that. Waterways, big deal. Grass strips, now there's prairie strips, but even before prairie strips, there were grass strips. And we just picked up a science project from Iowa State University that's actually going to be using our very mature grass strips and compare it to their prairie strips. It's the same principle, just different plants. So they're going to do a compare and contrast on that, which I think will be very interesting.
Now, what do you have in your grass strips?
Brome.
Yeah.
Just brome. We've had them for a long time. At its peak, where in its most extreme version, in the peak of season, you have the equivalent of 150 cows on 1 acre and move them every single day. And we think there's some huge environmental benefits of higher intensity grazing. We have several models, a move it every 5 days a week kind, and move it every three or four days, and move it every 2 weeks. We're trying various versions of high intensity grazing. But we've figured out it takes work on what the model is with the tenant on a lease to do that. Big environmental benefits, but how do you share the cost? And right now we keep tweaking our lease with our tenant, struggling to find what's fair. And we're getting there. Right now we share the cost of moving the cows with our tenant, because we have land benefits for sure by moving those cows every day.
So,
and he has benefits too in the he has more grass by moving the cows every day.
Well, I have a question. You say high intensity grazing has a lot of benefits, and so What are those benefits?
First of all, in terms of just grass production, the alternative to high-intensity grazing is continuous grazing. And in continuous grazing, the cows will mosey along every couple days and bite the top off the grass plant, which is the solar engine that makes everything work. And he just took the top of the engine off. And then a couple days later, the cow comes back and takes another bite. And the grass never really has enough solar engine leaves left to really kick it into gear. And so the idea of high-intensity grazing is, instead of the cow eating off the top every couple days, you let the cow eat that plant down to the ground, but it still has vigorous root system under it, in a day or two, and then kick the cow off and leave the poor grass plant alone for 60 or 90 days. Whereupon it'll come right back from the roots after the cow's eaten it off and produce a solar engine right away and just grow like mad and put on a great root system. And then in 90 days, the cow's back to eat the plant again. So you have much healthier root structures. You have more grass production.
And better weed management as well. And so the management-intensive grazing, functionally what it does is it keeps at the perfect intersection between nutritional quality for your whatever your livestock that you're grazing, in our case, cattle, and also the number of leaves to conduct photosynthesis. So it leaves the plant in a healthy state and also provides a consistent nutritional status over the course of the summer.
Another benefit is, since they're in such close quarters, the cows trample in their own manure, which they tend to spread it all across their small paddock they're in, as opposed to in continuous grazing, all the cow pies are around the water tank and, you know, not everywhere. So intensive grazing, you get a really even spread of the manure, which is, of course, fertilizer. And then another benefit is just we have different plant height everywhere. So, for example, our bobolink, if you're a bird watcher, this is the best place in the state, I bet, to see bobolinks. We have lots of them here.
And so this spring, we had our spring warbler count, and we had a lot of happy birders that were enjoying the bobolinks. So the males showed up a couple days earlier than the females, but there's a lot of activity, and it was a pleasure to see.
We have grass at all heights at any moment in time. So the birders were really liking our new grazing system, too. And we think we're building soil health with this system for sure. We're increasing our capacity to feed cows. I mean, we're increasing our agricultural productivity with the system. The downside is labor to move the cows. The infrastructure is actually pretty cheap. You know, we use hoses and two-strand high tensile, and it's the labor. And we spent last winter and all the winter before in our shop designing equipment so that we can move cows in an hour or less.
How many people does it take to move?
One person on an ATV and an hour or less to move the cows. And I don't know.
Just before you showed up, it took me 40 minutes to move them today.
So we're there now.
What species all do you have in your pasture, or is it the traditional?
That's another form of getting more sustainable. In the day, my father, who was a good grazer, I mean, he never overgrazed. He was a good grass guy, but he used continuous grazing. He used brome grass, and he put 160 pounds of nitrogen on every year, a real high-input, high-yield system. Pretty hard on water quality to put 160 pounds of nitrogen on pasture. So in the new era, in the White Rock era, to get greener, we've done a lot of interseeding of clovers in our pastures rather than using nitrogen fertilizer. We've started introducing patches of warm season grasses. Brome, cool season grasses are highly productive in the spring or fall. And to kind of make that season work well, our theory is some prairie pasture for the middle of the summer, that prairie really does well in hot season, warm season. So we have a longer grazing season, better managed grass by having different kinds of grass. We're also figuring out, by the way, that prairie hay isn't the best in a normal year, but in a dry year, when hay is short, we have hay for sale. Well, no one else does because of our prairie hay.
And should we have drier summers, which are predicted, then more prairie hay would be very desirable.
Prairie hay is desirable in a year when there's short of hay.
Correct. I was saying, for the pasture system, we're looking at scaling up to 20-25% of the pasture being warm season pasture. And the goal there is that through management intensive grazing, you can graze that and then get the cool seasons come back in and pick up spring grazing the next year as well as removing that cover and opening the canopy up for your warm season grasses the following summer. So,
can you have both warm season and cool season grasses on the same field?
You can. Depends on part of it is your grazing model, and we'll have to fiddle around with that a little bit as to how.
We do a lot of experiments here around White Rock too, which is really exciting. Right now, we're thrilled because one of our experiments just worked to our own amazement.
What was that?
We've been fooling around with planting soybeans into living cover crop. One of the issues of cover crop, we know they're great and have many benefits, but one of the management struggles with cover crops is how do you kill the cover crop in the spring? One choice is tillage, but tillage is death. It's terrible on soil to till it. And so right now we're using Roundup. And Roundup is working less and less well. Even if you don't have a particular problem with Roundup, it's not working very well anymore. Resistance is developing all over the place. A third method, by the way, is crimping it, which is just driving it over, but that happens in late May, and you got to plant your corn and soybeans before late May if you want to maximize your yield. So how do you kill cover crops? So one of our theories is don't. Don't kill the cover crops, at least not when you're planting soybeans. So we tried this last year, and it was a super wet spot where we tried it, and the rye sprouted standing up in the field and fell down on our soybeans and hurt our yield a little bit, though economically it was about a wash because we didn't kill the cover crop, which takes application of Roundup. Nor did we do a spring weed treatment because the cover crop held the weeds down. So we got out of two Roundup applications. This year we did it again more officially this time with replicated trials. Practical Farmers helped us set it up. We did it officially. And two out of our three strip plots, the soybeans and living rye did better. And we saved two Roundup applications. So we, at least in this year, which was a wet but not crazy wet year, we scored. This is a great thing. We did better by the environment. We used less Roundup. Our soybeans out-yielded our conventionally raised soybeans. Now, how cool is that?
That was a conversation between Rob Davis and Liz Garst. And Liz, we introduced before, but Rob Davis is the land manager at White Rock Conservancy. And so he's more the boots on the ground person, although there are also a couple of farmers who actually do all this farm labor that they're describing. And Liz is the oldest daughter and the member of the Garst family who's still physically involved in the farm. She lives in her house is on the property, and she is on the board of the White Rock Conservancy. And we had more conversation about the history, how the Garst family decided to create the foundation of the White Rock Conservancy. And so let's hear a little bit about that. This is Local Talk, KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM.
The Garth Farm was, I think, probably 2,000 acres. We didn't own that much land. We always had landlords. My granddad loved land, though, and bought land and fixed it up. He loved to take really eroded farms and grade out the ditches and seed them down and fix them up. Not all the land that is in the 5,000 was farm ground, which is the 2,000 acres I just told you. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was different than my father. Meanwhile, my father had been buying land all along.
This kind of land, what do you mean?
We're sitting in the middle of a beautiful river valley right here, and there's no corn to be seen where we sit right now. And the nearest corn's quite a ways away from right here, because we're in the middle of a very big river valley. That is natural.
Why did he do that?
My dad bought this kind of land because it was beautiful. And he bought cows to use it. He always said he needed the land because of the cows, or he needed the cows because of the land. And it depended on what department you were cornering him in on his finances, what he'd say. But the truth of the matter is he loved this land. He thought it was beautiful, and he bought it.
And at what point did you decide to create the White Rock Conservancy and share the land?
My father was a farmer, and in the 80s, he got in pretty bad financial trouble, along with pretty much every other farmer in the state. And to get out of it, he had to sell land to pay debt. And my sisters and I had some money from my grandfather. We were, you know, had a trust fund, basically, from my grandfather's seed company. So we had money, and we decided to buy land from him to help save him, but in the process, we bought this land. And when we did buy this land, we had a lot of discussions about why are we buying it. And we bought it because it was beautiful, but we also discussed that at some point, wouldn't it be great if it was a park, was our initial thought. And then much later, we were liquefying my father's business. We had the discussion much more intently on, okay, what do we mean by it's going to be a park? Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation came to our rescue. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation does a lot of great things in Iowa, and one of the best is it helps landlords figure out what to do with their land if they want to protect it in some way. They're real specialists in that. They have a booklet on that. So they did a lot of counseling with us on what to do, and we explored various options. It wasn't easy to figure out what to do. One option would be to give it to the DNR as one of the state's biggest public parks, which was our original idea. But in the interval, I had been involved in the Department of Natural Resources on the Natural Resource Commission and had been around and learned more and was not really very impressed with how the DNR manages land. They have parks where they manage people, and they have hunting grounds, but there's a lot of land that's not very well managed by the DNR, in my opinion. I had been into the importance of fire and in our oak forest ecology. The DNR was way behind on that. Furthermore, we figured out the DNR has no real intent or interest in agriculture, and a lot of this land is agriculturally based. And there's a lot of controversy about ag and the environment, but I've meanwhile become very clear that ag and the environment need to belong to each other. We need both things together. We need land to make money and have a way to pay property taxes, but we need a way to treat land well. And so ag and the environment are the same thing in so many ways. And
back to us.
What do
you see in the future of White Rock, like 20 years from now, what is it going to be, or how is it going to be?
Well, I hope it will be still very focused on how to do farming in an environmental way. I hope we're a glimmering, shining example of soil health, maybe even soil restoration, where we can make soil better, which between cover crops and livestock, in theory, we should be actually able to improve our soil as opposed to stop it from getting worse, which is where we're at in Iowa right now. How do we do that? If we have healthy soils everywhere, if we've sunk a lot of carbon here, which is another way to say we have healthy soils everywhere here, that would be great. And it would also be great if we have lots of people coming to enjoy this beautiful spot and learning about our environment and about agriculture.
We've been listening to a conversation about the development of the White Rock Conservancy with Liz Garst and earlier with Rob Davis. And you've been hearing just a little hint of the music from Ragtime in Randall from a couple years ago. And we have Paul Wearson on the line to tell us about what's happening this year. Hi, Paul. Are you there?
Oh, good morning, Susan. How are you?
Well, I'm great. And I'm so glad you're with us by phone.
Well, it's usually I'm down in the studio, and I've been dodging deer all the way down to get to Ames from Story City. But today, you've allowed me to come in by phone, and I want to compliment you on your program today. It was very interesting about agriculture and all the movements and changes, and I learned a lot, so I'm glad I got up early today.
Well, I'm glad you listened in before you had to get on the phone. So what have you been doing with Ragtime in Randall?
Well, for Ragtime in Randall, this is our 30th year of doing Ragtime in Randall. And for those people who are not familiar with Randall, it's a home to 150 people, but it has its own interstate exit. Okay, if you go north of Story City and you're headed to Minneapolis, the next exit of any significance is Randall, and it's just west of Interstate 35, and just take the exit right there marked Randall. And for 30 years, and this started out in a very inauspicious way, there was a man named Bob McNutt who had a piano tuning business up in Clarion, and one day somehow he came through Randall and fell in love with this little town and relocated his piano tuning business there, and then there was a Victorian mansion in town that he restored, and that's where he had his piano tuning business. And by and by, oh, he had a lot of friends like Bob Lean from Des Moines, who's a well-known organist and piano player down there and ragtime player, and they started to have little meetings at this Victorian mansion and put on programs, and well, eventually it grew into Ragtime in Randall, which became an annual festival, usually in October, as we're doing it this year, and drew people from all over the country. And, you know, there are several ragtime festivals around the country that are well-known and well-attended. You have the Scott Joplin Ragtime Festival in Sedalia, Missouri, the Rocky Mountain Ragtime Festival in Boulder, and all over the country, people still do ragtime. Well, and we're going to do an interview with Molly Cooney today at 10 for broadcast on KCCI at noon. And I thought, now Molly might ask me what ragtime is. So I looked it up in the dictionary. And Susan, I hope you're ready for a formal definition of ragtime.
Well, I am, but I have to remind you that you only have a couple minutes left.
Well, it's a style of jazz characterized by elaborately syncopated rhythms in the melody. It's hot piano playing, and we have two great performers this year. Rod Bienson, who is from Nevada, he's a local performer and well-known, and Brian Keenan, who's a composer and the foremost performer of ragtime, one of the best in the world, and he's headquartered in Minneapolis. They're going to be down here for Ragtime in Randall. Now, the schedule is 2 o'clock on Saturday, October 22nd. There'll be a program at 2 o'clock, 2 to 4. And then lunch, this is all at Elam Lutheran Church in Randall, and it's very easy to find when you drive into Randall from the exit on Interstate 35. It's right on your left as you come into town, and it's a church with very good acoustics. That's why we do it there. So there's a program at 2 to 4, then lunch from 4 to 5:30, and that is served by church ladies, okay? Now, you can't beat church ladies for lunch, and especially their delicious desserts like German chocolate cake. I can taste it right now. It's a fantastic place to eat between the two performances. Then at 5:30, we're doing another performance featuring both Brian and Rod, and it's just an opportunity for people to come up and do ragtime. And one of the original founders of ragtime, Ellis Anderson, who's now in his late 80s and living in a care facility, may be there to play ragtime. And we're hoping that Ellis can be there because he's one of the old friends of Bob McNutt, who founded Ragtime in Randall, and it would be very significant if Ellis is feeling well enough to play on Saturday. So we'll have Rod Bienson, Brian Keenan, who are outstanding performers, and you can come up and hear Ragtime. And by the way, Ragtime originated late in the 19th century and early 20th century, and I remember in the 50s when Elvis came out and rock and roll began, everyone thought that all teenagers were in trouble because this was such a suggestive music or whatever. Well, ragtime was the concern of parents in 1910. That ragtime was going to ruin our youth. It was a wild piano-playing music. And it's actually, ragtime is so intricate that only certain, very accomplished piano players can do it. And so we invite everyone to Randall this Saturday at 2 o'clock, performance at 2 o'clock, and another one at 5:30 with lunch by the church ladies. And if you come up there and come up to our performances and meet, and this is an opportunity not only to hear them, but to talk with these folks who perform and learn more about ragtime and just how fun it is, because this is really hot piano playing. And I'm inviting everybody to be there at Elam Lutheran Church on Saturday.
Well, thank you, Paul. That was some great introduction to ragtime for those who might not be familiar with it. And incidentally, we're going to go out with the show today, not with backtracking, but with a little bit of ragtime. So,
well, that's just wonderful.
Been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. We started out the show with Sally Worley, Executive Director of Practical Farmers of Iowa. Then we visited White Rock Conservancy in Coon Rapids, where we talked with Liz Garst and Rob Davis, land manager at the Conservancy. We closed out the program with Paul Wearson telling us a wonderful little story about this year's ragtime in Randall and ragtime in general.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Thanks to Ron Carson for taking care of the technical details of these posts with information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. You can also see a couple photos from our trip to White Rock. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered today by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking, but we didn't listen to it today. We listened to Reginald Robinson playing Daredevil's Gallop. And earlier we heard bits of Mary's Joy and Silent Theme. It's from the CD Reflections.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-9800. 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.